On Tuesday, March 7th, 2019, Melissa Sager illuminated stories from the Isles of Shoals in one of our local history talks. Among other qualifications, Melissa, who has a background in anthropology and library science, has worked as the curator of Star Island's Vaughan Cottage Library, Museum, and Archives, and served as a White Island Lighthouse steward. Our recording of the beginning of the lecture got cut off, but Melissa made some important points that we didn't want you to miss. We reached out to her via email, and she kindly provided us with the beginning of her transcript to share. It reads, "There are 9 islands in the Isles of Shoals, and 9 rocks or ledges. A state line runs right through them, so that 4 are in New Hampshire and 5 are in Maine. In New Hampshire, we have White, Seavey, Lunging, and Star. And in Maine, we have Cedar, Smutty Nose, Malaga, Appledore, and Duck. Recent archaeology has shown us that there was significant Native American settlement at the Isles of Shoals. Smutty Nose spear points have been dated to 6,000 years ago. Archaeologist Dr. Nathan Hamilton has been unearthing thousands of treasures and windows into the past for years now. When I started giving historical tours, we used to say that there was no definitive proof that there was a Native American presence at the Shoals, but now there is. In my last years there, I was displaying artifacts and creating fun posters like this one about the exciting new discoveries." And now here's where our recording picks up.
Captain John Smith of Pocahontas infamy came to the Isles of Shoals in 1614. He really loved the islands and tried to name them after himself, the Smith's Isles. The name didn't really stick, as there were already fishermen calling it the Isles of Shoals, but he did make a nice map of New England, including the islands, and greatly increased excitement across England about this area of the world. I have found one mention of the name Smith's Isles surviving in a newspaper clipping describing a fire on Star Island, but even then, they do clarify that they are better known as the Isles of Shoals. By the mid-1600s, some 600 to 1,000 fishermen and their families were living on the Isles of Shoals, most of them on Hog, now Appledore, and Smutty Nose Island. They made their living cod fishing. Fishermen dried out the cod on fish flakes, or drying racks, a way to preserve them for overseas transport. They used to say you could walk on the water on the backs of fish. The sea was so thick with bounty there. This is 2 Shoals fishermen with a halibut. The people who lived on the islands were famous for being very independent, lawless, and big drinkers. Many fishermen did not drink or fish on Sundays, though, the Lord's Day, due to a couple of convincing stories which turned into superstition. John Scribner Jeunesse recalls that in 1643, 3 fishermen who were profane and scorners of religion began drinking on the Lord's Day. Their boat was cast away the next week, and they all drowned. In Religion at the Isles of Shoals, Lois Williams relates the story Reverend Brock, minister on the islands from 1650 to 1662. He was asked by fishermen if they could fish on Sunday instead of going to church, since they had missed some days of fishing due to weather. He let anyone fish, but promised to pray for large catches for those who stayed. 30 fishermen went fishing instead of going to church and couldn't catch more than 4 fish. The 5 who had stayed and attended church fished afterwards and took 500 fish. After that, the fishermen attended services whenever Reverend Brock had them. Lois explains that the story of Reverend Brock may have been exaggerated sermonizing by Reverend Cotton Mather, who relays this story in one of his sermons, but with superstitious sailors, the myth can be just as powerful as the truth. In 1679 to 1680, when Massachusetts tried to tax the people living on Hog Island, now Appledore, which was then a part of Massachusetts Bay Colony, 40 families took apart their houses, loaded them on boats, and rowed over to Star Island in New Hampshire, where they formed the town of Gosport to evade that tax. There was fear 100 years later, during the Revolutionary War, that the independent islanders might aid the British. So in 1778, New Hampshire ordered the people living in Gosport to the mainland. So they once again had to pack up their homes, literally their houses, load them onto boats, and float them 6 miles to shore, where many landed in Rye, New Hampshire. Some went to York, Maine, and some of the homes from the islands can still be seen there today. At least one house made it as far as Ipswich, Mass. After the war, some residents returned to the island, but the population never returned to its pre-war numbers. You may know the name Thomas Layton as the name of the ferry that takes passengers to the Isles of Shoals today from Portsmouth. I learned from Sandpiper, the biography of Celia Thaxter, written by her granddaughter Rosamond Thaxter, that Thomas Layton first desired to be an islander in September of 1831. He was handed a flyer for an auction of the late Benjamin Haley's estate, including three of the islands of the Isles of Shoals. After discussing the possibility with his wife Eliza, he rode to Kittery to the auction to bid on them, but he was outbid. For years, he lamented that the islands had slipped through his fingers and dreamed about what he would have done with them. In April of 1839, almost 8 years after he first tried, he purchased those same three islands, Hog, Smuttynose, and Malaga, jointly with his brother Joseph. Thomas Layton also came to White Island to be the lighthouse keeper that same year, 1839, with his wife Eliza, his daughter Celia, who was 4 years old, and son Oscar, who was 3 months old. Son Cedric came soon after. Thomas Layton would go on to build the Mid-Ocean House of Entertainment on Smuttynose and the Appledore House on Hog Island, renaming Hog to Appledore Island, using the name of the earlier settlement there, for better advertising, because no one wants to vacation at the Hog House. Thomas Layton's daughter Celia married her tutor Levi Thaxter, who was 11 years her senior. Levi introduced Celia to the literary scene in Boston. Celia Thaxter became quite famous for her own poetry, prose, her garden, her china painting, and the famous artistic people that she surrounded herself with and entertained on Appledore. C.T. Young, the writer, describes her. Celia Thaxter was, I sometimes think, the most beautiful woman I ever saw. Not the most splendid, nor the most regular in feature, but the most graceful, the most easy, the most complete, with a suggestion of perfect physical adequacy and mental health in every look and motion. She abounded in life. It was like breathing a new life to look at her. Many famous artists, musicians, and writers flocked to Celia. Here on Appledore is Child Hassam painting, composer William Mason in a swing, many creatives on Celia's porch, and writer Sarah Orne Jewett. This is the Appledore Hotel. This is the Appledore Pier. This is the Appledore Bathhouse, swimming and boating area. Alice Brown on Appledore, who sat for some of Child Hassam's paintings as a model. Guests on the rocks at Appledore. And Celia in her parlor. You can see her, she looks kind of ghosty. Celia's family line is still connected to the Shoals. Here are five of her direct descendants on Appledore. They were attending a conference on Star Island and came with other guests to my historical tour. Here they are in front of the foundation of Celia Thaxter's cottage in the recreation of her garden. I am pretty sure Celia Thaxter had a bear. The only reason for me to doubt it is that I haven't seen a photograph or some concrete evidence that it existed, like a receipt for bear food in the Appledore Hotel ledgers. That, and because almost everyone I tell doesn't seem to believe it. But Celia Thaxter wrote a story about it, Oscar Layton wrote an account of it in his autobiography, and Fred McGill wrote the story down many years later. Celia's niece remembers it. There is even a story in the Christian Register from the point of view of the little girl on lunging. But as a natural skeptic and a student of history, who knows full well that sometimes fiction can be handed down as truth and told and retold until everyone believes it, I had some doubt. So I'll walk you through my process in preparing for this talk in order to take care of the first obvious objection, A bear on an island, or anywhere, that's just ridiculous. It may seem quite strange to us today, but Wikipedia tells me that a tame bear, often called a dancing bear, is a wild bear captured when the animal is young, or born and bred in captivity, and used to entertain people in streets or taverns. Dancing bears were commonplace throughout Europe and Asia from the Middle Ages to the 19th century, and can still be found in the 21st century in some countries. It goes on to say that there were dancing bears in India and Spain until 2007, 2009. These pictures are used for humor, but this is actually a tame bear living with a family in Russia. I went through Google image searches, and here's a bear in London advertising for an upcoming fair in the 1800s. 1895, another dancing bear in a London street. 1890s, a dancing bear on Prince Edward Island. Enid Michaels in Yosemite in the 1920s. And I've seen a bear riding a bicycle and eating ice cream right here in New Hampshire at Clark's Trading Post. Has anyone been there? So it's not actually as far-fetched as it first seems. Here is the illustration that went with Celia's story when it was first published in St. Nicholas. This is more the size of the bear we're talking about. It was a tiny baby bear for most of the time it was there. We've probably all seen dogs bigger than this bear. The story starts to feel less ridiculous. Also, demanding photographic proof is a taller order than I first assumed. Today, we take pictures of every beautifully crafted salad, but back in the Leighton Thaxter household of old, not a single photograph exists of Thomas Leighton, patriarch and owner of several whole islands of the Isles of Shoals, builder and proprietor of the 500-room Appledore House and the Mid-Ocean House of Entertainment on Smutty Nose. Zero photos of him and only 24 surviving photos of Celia Thaxter, one of the most famous poets of her time. If we have 0 to 24 photos of two of the very most influential people in Isles of Shoals history, the fact that a bear was there for about 2 years and we can't find a photo seems a lot more reasonable, excusable, and perhaps expected. In the volume, Celia Thaxter's selected writings, in a preface to a group of stories, including the bear at Appledore, Julia Older writes, "Most of the stories, according to Celia, hardly are stories at all, but real life incidents that occurred at the Isles of Shoals, and that the Spray Sprite, which is a different story altogether, comes closest to genuine fiction." I do like to call this little bit of history Celia Thaxter's bear, but Fred McGill is the only one who actually names her as the owner, though it is always her family, more broadly, in other accounts, who owns the bear. So in Celia's telling, the bear comes as a baby from Georgia, is tethered to a stick in front of the hotel where children play, often roughly, poking sticks at him. In September, the bear broke free from his chain during a severe storm where he must have been badly frightened. She found him while walking on some cliffs when she heard something between a hiss and a whistle from a gorge below. She said, "A black heap curled up on a shelf of rock just below me, a few feet out of reach. He looked so comfortable, for it was the sunniest, coziest nook." She left him, and they didn't see him again for 7 months. Someone saw him clambering over a rock wall, and some men chased him. She says, "He plunged bravely over the rocks and suddenly disappeared, as a drop of water soaks into the ground in a large seam in the side of the hill. There they found his cave all strewn with bones and the feathers of fowls. They caught him and brought him back, where Celia led him about from place to place, even brought him into the house, though he was as large as a Newfoundland dog, and spread a mat for him in the corner. He disappeared a second time, and he was the terror of all the mothers who came to Appledore, and the children were guarded with the greatest care. Though Celia says, there wasn't any reason for so much alarm. He hid for another winter, and when he emerged for the second time, behold, he waxed huge and terrible to see." This is when they decided to bring the bear, by rowboat, to Lunging Island. Celia liked to collect wild pink morning glories on lunging and saw the bear grown bigger still. He was huge, heavy, horrid. A girl comes out of the cottage whose description includes dressed in a flaming pink calico gown, and over her shoulders tumbled a thicket of dull carrot red hair, which looked as if it had never seen a comb. So dry, so rough, so knotted and tangled it was. This girl says something Celia can't understand at first, and she gradually realizes the girl's asking for 5 cents to see the bear. Celia declines, says she has seen the bear before, and that she has no money on her. They brought the bear back to Appledore in September, but he had a large appetite. He prowled about, seeking what he might devour. Bolts and bars were nothing to him. Such little impediments as windows he minded not in the least, but calmly lumbered through them, taking sash, glass, and all as he came. Then he made off with everything he could find in the way of provender, and kept himself hidden all day, safely out of the sight of men. Eventually, he broke into the biggest storeroom, where he made too much a mess, and spent the greater part of the night in that blissful lake of molasses. It was decided that this bear was too expensive to keep, and he had to be killed. As he was still on the loose, they kept watch for him. Someone was shingling a roof when they spotted him. They said he was steeping himself in sunshine after his night's orgy in the storeroom. Before he knew that danger was near, the sun had ceased to shine for that poor bear. This is a very blurry picture of Barbara Leighton Durant, who is Celia Thaxter's niece, who says she remembers the bear going missing and that she was often frightened when walking alone on Appledore. She was haunted by the story of the bear hiding nearby, and it would give her a thrill to walk where she could imagine the bear lurking. From the main women writers collection at the University of New England, Mary Jane Lee, who's later known as Molly Lee, had the distinction of being the only child born on Londoners Island, which we call Lunging. Molly was much younger than her siblings and very much alone on the island, roaming its beaches, befriending its creatures, and relying on her imagination to amuse her. Being a very religious Shoals fisherman with extensive knowledge of the Bible, her father Thomas preached from Pulpit Rock to the fishermen in their boats. Although he had little education and the family lived in a one-room shack with a loft, Leahy managed to buy Lunging Island at some point during their time there. Molly's solitary childhood had the good fortune to have the generous, inspiring attention of neighboring Appledore Island poet Celia Thaxter. Thaxter gave the young Molly books, trinkets, ribbons, and even pets, including a homing pigeon and a young bear. And it was she who inspired young Molly to learn to read and write. Molly composed her first poem at the age of 6, the subject of which was the death of a pet hen, a precursor to her later writings that often focused on her love of animals. Given this description of Molly's life as so familiar to Celia's early life, and the list of ways that Celia helped and encouraged Molly, giving her gifts and inspiring her, is all the more odd that Celia wrote of her in the Bear of Appledore story as unkempt, and then further in the story went on to say she was like a funny little gnome, and later she turned and hopped back with a motion and clumsiness more like a large pink toad than a human being. Nevertheless, in April 4th, 1907, in the Christian Register, is published this very short story about the bear from Molly Lee Clifford herself, perhaps hoping to paint herself in a better light. The title is On Londoner's Island, and I'll only quote from part of it. Molly's father came home one day with a baby bear, and Molly, remembering a circus she had once seen, decided to start a menagerie of her own. She would ask 5 cents for a visit, for she reasoned that if people in the city were willing to pay 50 cents to see a great many animals, surely they ought to be willing to pay 5 cents to see even one bear. She sees Celia approaching by boat. From her seat among the goldenrod, Molly waited until Mrs. Thaxter was close at hand. Then she jumped out at her. "If you please, would you like to see my tame bear? It's only 5 cents to see him, and he will stand on his head and do lots of tricks." Celia Thaxter declines, saying she has seen the bear before. Molly later in the day asks her father what she meant by having seen the bear before, and he said, "Why, I suppose she saw it when her brother owned it." Molly's forehead wrinkled in a frown of distress. "I asked her to pay me money to see it," she said. Her father laughed softly. "I guess you needn't worry," he said reassuringly. "Mrs. Thaxter was a little girl once herself." The Woodman Institute in Dover, New Hampshire, has this painting by Molly and talks about her two novels. These are her two novels, Yappy and Polly, by autobiographies of a monkey and a parrot. In The Isles of Shoals and Lorne Legend by Lyman Rutledge, I found that Celia Thaxter also had a parrot. Celia became aware one day that the bird's raucous laughter was an imitation of her own. Her friends observed that later in life, her laughter was more subdued. In Sandpiper, Celia is quoted as writing, "Polly hangs in one window. She has learned my unfortunate laugh and keeps it up from morning till night, peal upon peal. It is irresistible." In a letter to John Greenleaf Whittier, Celia writes, "We hung the parrot out at the door and she imitated the whole flock of sheep and the cows and ducks and hens gathered within her pen and ordered the house about imperatively. She likes to be out in the sun, but when she grew tired, she called me, 'Celia, Celia,' till we took her in. Then she said, 'God love that girl,' as she hears Oscar say, 'She is too weird for this world.' How you must miss Charlie. This bird is worth half a dozen people for entertainment. She flew away while mother was gone last autumn over to Star, and the islanders, taking her for a hawk, were about to shoot her when she called loud and clear, 'Cedric,' and just saved herself." Oscar has a slightly different version of the same story in his 90 years at the Isles of Shoals. He says, "Christopher Rhymes came down Christmas time, bringing a parrot for mother, and this bird made great fun for us. Paul was very fond of coffee and would scream at breakfast time until she got it. The bird must have come over from Africa on a ship navigated by naughty sailors, for she had learned to swear in three languages." One day, Paul got out of doors and flew to Smutty Nose. One of the men there, thinking it was a hawk, was about to shoot when Polly sung out, "You go to hell." The man fled. The Smutty Nose murders were committed 146 years ago tomorrow morning. Still under the cover of pre-dawn darkness, here in the Haunt Vent House on March 6th, 1873. I've read a lot about them in past years, but I just got the chance to read J. Dennis Robinson's book that came out 5 years ago, detailing the gruesome crime. It has a ridiculously comprehensive amount of information about the murder case, along with a lot of other bits of Shoals history interwoven throughout. An example of new bits of color that are revealed: I didn't know that all of Karen's teeth were extracted not long before the murder, not a part of the murder. So she had no teeth as she was being killed. Kind of a strange point to ponder, but I found it really fascinating. Also, a specialist in the murder trial was called in to remark upon the suspect Louis Wagner's clothes as being covered with either fish or human blood. The specialist said that it was human blood. The process used to determine this was later proven to be unscientific, and the specialist was more than possibly a double murderer himself, killing his own wife and son in an attempt to inherit money. Robinson also completely dismisses a fan favorite alternate murderer theory: the suggestion that Celia's mentally and physically challenged son, Carl Thaxter, was somehow involved in the tragedy is beyond ridiculous and unworthy of comment. Karen, one of the victims, had worked for Celia and her family at the Appledore Hotel for 2 years, but fired from this job in Appledore just 2 weeks before the murder. Cedar described it in epic terms as one of the most memorable days in the history of the Appledore Hotel. I won't dwell on the demise of Karen and Aneth, as there are many sources where you can read more about the brutal murder of these two women, the most complete being Mystery on the Isles of Shoals, Closing the Case on the Smutty Nose Axe Murders of 1873 by J. Dennis Robinson. J. John Poor of Poor and Stickney Spices came out and stayed at the Appledore Hotel and asked many logistical questions of Oscar and Cedric while he secretly had a third party buying up all of the property on Star Island. In the end, John Poor had purchased all but one plot of land, and subsequently the town of Gosport had to be dissolved. The fishing village at the Isles of Shoals all but vanished. John Poor built the state-of-the-art Oceanic in 1873, the same year as the Smutty Nose murders. In fact, Marin, who escaped, tried to signal over to the workmen on Star. They were building the Oceanic right across the harbor from Smutty Nose in the morning before her rescue. The Oceanic burned just 2 years later, November 11, 1875. The morning the Oceanic burned, the fire was so bright it woke up residents of Portsmouth, 10 miles across the sea. They thought the fire was in Portsmouth, it was so intense. It was also seen distinctly from Charlestown, Massachusetts. Oscar Leighton said, Mr. Poor, with dauntless energy, commenced at once to build the present Oceanic before the ashes of the first building cooled off. John Poor took materials he was going to use to expand his first hotel, built the current Oceanic that stands today, cobbled together with other older island buildings, moved and joined to create a larger hotel, not nearly as grand as the first. This is the older Atlantic House, which was a boarding house on Star Island that they moved and made a part of the current Oceanic. This is the Gosport House and the Berry House. And this is the new construction from the leftover building materials that you can see is very similar to the first Oceanic. Not long after, John Poor gave up the hotel business and convinced Oscar and Cedric to buy Star Island and the Oceanic from him. So then they began operating the Appledore Hotel and the Oceanic at the same time. Painter William Morris Hunt was a good friend of Levi Thaxter's. He became quite depressed, and in July 1879, during a visit to the Shoals with his friend, he drowned at Appledore, an apparent suicide. In a letter to Annie Field, Celia writes, I found him. It was reserved for me, who loved him truly, that bitterness. All the island was seeking him. It was I who went to the brink of that lovely little lake. They tried to find some life. There was none. We took him in, put in blankets, rubbed and rubbed. It was mockery. He had been dead hours. Oh, how grand he looked when we laid him down and laid him rest at last. Beautiful, dear fellow. We could not keep away from him. He was fascinating even in death. We sat and gazed and tried to believe it. From one drowning straight to another, we come to the tragedy of the waitresses. Lyman V. Relich's 6-volume omnibus edition of The Isles of Shoals in Lore and Legend, Volume 5, recounts the story fully, and I will quote heavily from it here. I have condensed and paraphrased it a bit for you, but there was so much great detail that I couldn't cut much. Captain Frederick Miles, a 48-year-old local fisherman, lived with his wife and 11 children in Portsmouth and had taken many sailing parties out of the Shoals. The summer of 1902, he was employed by the manager of the Oceanic Hotel on Star Island. Miles operated an Ipswich Bay whaleboat, well known locally as a reliable sailing craft for small parties. The Ipswich Bay was usually about 20 feet long, rigged with 2 masts and sails. The loose-footed foresail was somewhat higher and larger than the mainsail. The boat was decked over, bow and stern, and was heavily ballasted with stone and iron. There was room amidship for 6 or 10 passengers, no more, says an expert writing for the Boston Journal. Miles had no record of accidents or careless conduct, and Mr. Ramsdell, the hotel manager, had complete confidence in the captain's experience and judgment. On July 17, 1902, by his own account, Captain Miles had taken out a small party in the early afternoon, and on returning them to Appledore, was handed a message informing him that there was a party waiting on Star. A member of the party, which had just been out, says they noticed a black cloud in the south and asked the captain to make haste to the wharf to escape a squall. As soon as they got out of the boat, a party of 15 waitresses got in over the previous party's protest. 5 waitresses did refuse to go, though they had desired to join the party. They stayed on the pier and watched the others sail off. Skipper Miles said, "I never sailed a jollier party than these young people. I said to them, 'Where do you want to go, girls?' And they told me just to sail around the islands and not to go too far out. There was a brisk breeze from the southeast, so the skipper headed northwest, intending to keep within the lee of the islands, and as he came up the west coast of Appledore, young Oliver Adams, brother of Ella, who had stayed behind, and 2 other sisters who were on the boat, shouted and waved to turn back. But the party sailed on and cruised for nearly an hour to the north and east of Appledore. The Reverend Charles E. Park watched the whole performance from the piazza of the Oceanic, and after more than 50 years revived his memory of it in a note for our living history. He says, "A young fisherman had offered to take them for a sail, and probably it was up north toward Boone Island. On their return, they were surging merrily along, close-hauled on the port tack to a brisk southwest breeze. The girls were all ranged along the port gunwale to offset the list of the boat. As they opened up the harbor between Appledore and Star, so they could see the steamboat pier, there was the steamer just in and bringing another batch of delegates. Very soon, they had to go about on the starboard tack in order to shoot up into the Appledore harbor. This was just what the girls wanted, for now, with the boat listing to port, they could all crowd over to the starboard side and get a perfect view of the passengers leaving the steamer not 50 feet away. And then it happened. The boat slipped into the lee of the steamer, and the wind pressure on the sail was cut off. The boat righted with a jerk, and because all the weight was on the starboard side, she kept right on listing to starboard until water was pouring, green and heavy, over the gunwale. Being well ballasted to make her stiff when on the wind, she sank like a plummet." It seems from various descriptions that the entire list of 17, including the skipper, were carried down by the suction of the rapidly descending boat. No one was caught in the rigging, and no one fell beneath the hull. The skipper said, "My God, girls, it's all over. We are all gone," he yelled. And that was the last he saw of any of the party. As the boat sank, they were all drawn under by the terrible whirl and suction. But as the craft struck the bottom, the air in her forced Miles up to the surface again. He recalls, "I was down for more than a minute, I should judge, and when I saw blue sky was some distance from where we went under. Luckily, a large soap box, which had been in the boat, was floating by, and I put my arms around it. This was my salvation, as I cannot swim a stroke, although I've worked on the water for more than 30 years." Oliver Adams and Lemuel Davis were first to reach the floundering victims. They watched the boat go out and watched it capsize. They ran to the shore and launched a dory. Oliver says, "The breakers were coming high and strong, but we got out there first. Davis had the oars, and I never thought we would get to the drowning girls. It was an awful suspense. When we got to where she went down, all were bunched. I grasped 2 of the girls, not knowing who they were, and rowed rapidly to shore. I kept their heads out of the water as best I could, but it was a hard job to go through the breakers. We were about 15 yards from the shore when I was thrown out of the boat, but still kept hold of my girls. After a time, we succeeded in reaching dry land, and then we turned our efforts to resuscitating the girls. It was then for the first time that I discovered that one of them was my sister, Ina. I did not know that she was in the boat. After fully a half hour, we succeeded in restoring Miss Haggerty. My sister was undoubtedly dead when we reached the shore." Allward and Farrington were 2 others who selflessly dove into the water to attempt to aid the doomed sailing party. They were struggling and trying to hold several of the girls above the water. Both were expert swimmers, but they could not hold out in the sea against such odds. The steamer Sam Adams, which had just discharged her passengers at the dock, now made for the rescue with only her skipper, Charles Allen, and the engineer, Peter Peterson, aboard. They threw a line to one girl who proved to be Lillian Bresnahan and drew her aboard, but the second was too feeble to hold on and sank. Winds and waves were driving the steamer onto the rocks, so she had to pull away from shore and rescued no others. By this time, the waters were in tumult. Fishermen from Star and Smutty Nose came in dories to join the frantic efforts of the Appledore boys. These boats, bobbing like corks on the choppy sea, managed to recover 8 floating victims. These were brought to shore where the whole population of the islands was reaching out for them, and doctors Warren and Richter were directing fruitless first aid. The bodies were carried on cots to the music room of the Appledore Hotel and placed in a silent row for identification by friends and relatives from Star. 9 in all, 5 missing, somewhere still under the salvage wave. Word had been cabled to a coroner in Kittery and the undertaker in Portsmouth. After the bodies were identified, they were carried on mattresses to the boat and taken to Portsmouth, where they were claimed by relatives. The next day, Michael Hurley was summoned to recover 5 missing bodies. He had his own diving equipment and early Saturday morning went down to explore the ocean bed. He found the whaleboat intact and announced that Skipper Miles had not been at fault in handling his sails. Some had said he failed to free his sails in making his tack, and it was a tight sail which caused the boat to capsize, but Hurley found no tight sail. One at a time, he discovered the sunken bodies at a depth of about 60 feet, but it was not until the next afternoon that all had been recovered. Some faces were still recognizable, but others had been disfigured by fish. All were taken to Portsmouth. Guests at both hotels asked for no service on the evening of the tragedy. Appledore recovered more quickly after the last victim had been taken to mainland, and the seas were calm once more, but the Oceanic could not be reconciled. Guests came from their rooms the next morning in silence and seemed confused as they entered the dining room, where only a handful of waitresses with haggard faces were there to serve them. Out of 22, 16 were absent, 14 never to return to their places. Orders were given with choked voices, if at all. Many had no heart for eating, but would rise without words and return to their rooms. Days passed and new hands came to serve, but memory lingered long over those dark hours. Dr. Park speaks for them all in his later review. You say, why begin your reminiscences with so sad a story? Had you been an ardent shoaler at the time, could you have forgotten it? Could you have attended a single session for the next 50 years without at least once during the week recalling that fearful tragedy? The 14 drowned included 3 sets of sisters. The lost waiters and waitresses were Ina and May Adams, sisters from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Winfred A. Alward, assistant head waiter of Fredericton, New Brunswick, Catherine and Elizabeth Bowes, sisters from Saxonville, Mass, Bessie A. Chase of Malden, Mass, Henry C. Farrington, head waiter of Cambridge, Mass, Laura Bell Gilmore of Exeter, Mass, and Bertha Graham of Danvers, Mass, Isabel Koska of Cambridge, Mass, Eva and Mary Marshall, sisters from Haver, Mass, Minnie McDonald of Cambridge, Mass, Anna E. Sheenahan of West Medford, Mass. There were multiple efforts to save some of the girls, but only the captain, Fred Miles, and 2 waitresses, Lillian Bresnahan and Alice Haggerty, survived. Many of the girls were thought to have been weighed down by their heavy, water-soaked wool skirts. In a newspaper article, it was written that Henry Farrington, the head waiter, and Winfred Alward, the assistant waiter, were both law students at Harvard University, rooming at Forsyth Hall. Both were good swimmers and lost their lives trying to rescue the others. On the 110th anniversary of the tragedy of the waitresses, 14 fish in the main tank in the Rutledge Marine Lab on Star Island drowned because they didn't have enough oxygen in the tank. The saltwater pump had malfunctioned, so the water was not being supplied enough movement and oxygen, which the fish depend upon. One of the fish survived, much like one of the waitresses was revived. At first, I really didn't believe it. I thought someone was playing a prank on me. We were always playing pranks. I didn't know fish could drown. I had to see the dead fish to believe it and see Arthur Eves in the marine lab cleaning up the mess. In the early 1900s, the Appledore and Oceanic Hotels weren't faring well financially. Oscar had been trying to sell the 95 acres of Appledore, broken up into 585 house lots. This is ridiculous, as so many of those lots would have been utterly useless, being all crags and rocks. The Appledore Hotel burned to the ground in November of 1914. Oscar was on Star Island at the beginning of the blaze and said that the paint on the Oceanic on Star was bubbling. The heat was so intense. Star is not far from Appledore, but the area between them does stretch across Gosport Harbor, past Smutty Nose and Malaga Islands, past Appledore Gut, past the mounding hill of one half of Appledore before the valley where the grand, historic, distinguished Appledore House was collapsing into ash. Many of the other buildings burned with the hotel, but a few were saved up on the hill as they were further away and the wind was blowing in the opposite direction. These were some of the houses that were saved, and that red arrow is where the hotel was. Sadly, Celia's parents' home, which later became hers, burned with the hotel. After the fire, Appledore was all but abandoned for many years, essentially until the Shoals Marine Lab was created. The Shoals Marine Lab on Appledore today is an academic outpost focused on undergraduate marine research. Sometimes I like to talk about Oscar Leighton's life, as it spans the three major eras I use most often to talk about Shoals history: the fishing era, the hotel era, and the conference era. Oscar was there for them all. Oscar came out to White Island when he was only 3 months old with his parents, Thomas and Eliza Leighton, and his older sister, Celia. He didn't go back to the mainland until he was 16 years old, when he saw Portsmouth for the first time at 16. He had also never seen a tall tree or the bustling of a real street. He was so startled and disoriented, he went back to the Isles of Shoals and did not leave again for a long time. He spent almost all of his life on the Isles of Shoals, and he lived a long time, 99 years and 9 months. He arrived during the decline of the fishing village of Gosport, and he lived through the Grand Hotel era. His father, Thomas Leighton, built and operated the first mid-ocean house of entertainment, and then the Appledore Hotel. He and his brother Cedric took over running the Appledore Hotel and later the Oceanic on Star Island as well. In Sandpiper, Rosamond writes of Oscar, "Each year since the opening of the Appledore House, the bearded young Viking had found a new sweetheart with the arrival of the summer guests. He would adore each in turn and be desolate when she left in the autumn." Mm-hmm. He wrote impassioned verses to them one by one. In the year 1880, however, came the love of his life, Lucy Darby. Lucy's parents had other plans for her, and when she left him, Oscar's health broke, and he wished only to die. A trip to Europe was advised for him as the best possible cure. This was one out-of-character major departure from the islands, as he obeyed this advice. He indeed sailed across the Atlantic on the Batavia, and took in many sights with his sister Celia. But first, on the dock as they were about to leave, when the last whistle had blown and the ship was pulling out, Oscar spied Lucy waving her shawl from the dock. He went wild to the great excitement of the passengers and was with difficulty restrained from climbing over the rail to swim back to the girl he loved. The ocean voyage was not always calm. In a letter, Celia writes, "The boat pitched like a maniac, and she rolled like a drunken elephant. At every plunge, her propeller was bare to the blast and made her shake and quiver like an aspen, or better, like the variations on the violin in the Kreutzer Sonata. Celia loved the rest of the trip, except for Naples. She said, God made Naples the divinest place. Men have converted it into a pigsty of unspeakable squalor. She went as far as to suggest it should be buried under lava like Pompeii. Though Oscar still moped and grumbled about for some of the trip, he managed to have the most beautiful Christmas of his life, and then in Paris, he was taken to a show where he said there were many beautiful girls who did not have much of any clothes on. Soon upon their return to America, little brother Cedric was married, and much of the running of both the Oceanic and Appledore hotels fell to Oscar. When Oscar could no longer afford to keep the hotels, due to debt and the changes in transportation that brought guests elsewhere in New England, the Unitarians purchased the island, namely Lewis Parkhurst, who held it until the Star Island Corporation could take it over. Thomas and Lilla Elliott, pictured to the right of Oscar, had started bringing Unitarian conferences to the Isles of Shoals in 1897. They filled both the Appledore and Oceanic hotels to capacity. The staff of the hotels even gave up their own sleeping quarters and set up cots in the bathrooms to allow overflow of guests to sleep in their rooms. Though the Unitarians purchased the island, and it was no longer Oscar's, they were so fond of him that they allowed him to live there. He had a room on the third floor of Cottage A, and later on the first floor of Cottage C. Thus, Oscar fully experienced three of the major uses of the islands, as a fishing village, a place for grand hotels, and as a conference center. Celia is usually touted as the island artist, but Oscar himself had many interests and talents. He drew pictures, mostly of boats and fish. He also wrote poetry and prose, though he was not recognized as a writer. He constructed buildings on Appledore, the honeymoon cottage on Lunging, which was ironic as he never married, so had no honeymoon. The steeple of the chapel on Star Island used to be of wood, and he rebuilt it out of stone. He operated a telegraph office on Appledore Island. He invented a washing machine. He loved to row his boat Twilight, talked to people young and old, and was a true treasure of the Islands of Shoals. I wrote that, that he was a true treasure of the Isles of Shoals, because I've always loved the stories of Oscar. I love the pictures of him. And compared to the very few that remain of the rest of his family, he is all over the place. He is the costumed Disney princess that everyone wanted a picture with while on their summer vacation. But even with Oscar, there is a darker side, a seedy side. I don't know why I don't like to talk about it. I guess I like to keep it light. He was very flirty and handsy with the waitresses. His breakfast was delivered to him in his room. I'm not quite sure if this was due to his celebrity status or perhaps room service was common practice for guests. I'm not sure the extent of what may have taken place, but in order to protect the waitresses, but also not diminish Oscar's service, they cut a hole in the wall of his room in Cottage A to make a little window to the hallway and installed a sliding door so that the waitresses delivering his breakfast could drop it off without having to physically interact. To be touched like him, especially in the light of wealthy, powerful men being exposed for doing atrocious things to young people and getting away for it for so many years, it makes me a little nervous as to what may have actually occurred to make the hotel management saw through the wall for a safety hatch. Even Grace Colley, at the very end of her short account, said, Oscar used to joke me, whatever that means. Grace Colley is the woman who lived on Duck Island for 11 years. If you have ever seen Duck Island up close or stayed much at the Isles of Shoals, this seems like quite a feat to think of living there at all. Nevertheless, for such a long time. The most removed and desolate of all the islands, it doesn't seem to have enough space to build a cottage that wouldn't be washed over in a storm. In Sprays of Salt, John Bragg Downs says, 2 miles northeast from Appledore, Duck Island thrusts out its lurking edges on all sides beneath the water, one of them running half a mile to the northwest. This is the most dangerous of the islands and, being the most remote, is the only one visited to any great degree by the shy sea fowl that are nearly banished by civilization. Today there are cormorants, eider ducks, herring, and black-back seagulls on Duck Island. There is also a significant seal population there, both harbor and gray seals. The Shoals Marine Lab counted 800 seals in 2016. But the fauna of the island has changed a lot over the years. After a great depletion in the 1800s, herring seagulls only started nesting on duck again in the 1920s, and the seagulls only really increased after World War II. So Grace may have lived there in the brief period where there would have been little to no seagulls, which is a major difference from today. I don't know how many of you know how violent seagulls are out there. It's a big deal. From the Jesse Donahue collection in the Vaughan Cottage Archives, there is an account of Mrs. Donahue speaking with Grace Colley. Grace says that she lived on duck for 11 years and spent 14 or 15 winters at the Shoals. She came over when she was 13 and worked at the hotel since she was 14. She says, bushels of field strawberries grew on duck, and we had sheep there, a dozen of them, and sheep on Smutty Nose too. 1 year after the smallpox, perhaps 25 years ago, a girl came to Appledore and was sent to Smutty Nose. She was isolated in a sheep pen, like a pest house. My husband's father ran the Mid-Ocean House for 12 years. There were trained nurses and a doctor came from Portland. Sick folks were kept quiet and they got well. The house held 25 to stay and put up tents. Ma had 8 or 10 tents. Thomas Layton did market the Shoals as the ideal sanatorium site for invalids who would profit from the peaceful island pace and its fresh, healthful salt air. And in an 1855 article, Layton claimed to have cured 5 out of 6 consumptives who stayed at their hotel. Grace Colley, a humble chambermaid, certainly saw a lot on the islands. Fishermen, snowdrifts over her head, boats going down in storms, and the hotels prospering. Here is her cottage on duck. Lyman V. Rutledge was a minister and historian at Star Island for many years. He founded a secret society on Star Island called the Dawn Birds sometime around the 1920s. A description of the Dawn Birds from Fred McGill's book, Something Like a Star. Lyman it was, beyond all others, who opened our eyes to the beauties of the islands. In fact, he opened our eyes quite literally when he lured us from our beds, led us out to East Rock before sunrise, and let us watch with him the birth of a new day. Lyman watched the sunrise, but he watched us younger shoalers too, and if, the first time out, we kept our tongues from wagging and let our appreciation show in quiet attentiveness, he might invite us to join the Society of Dawn Birds, a secret and very special flock of sunrise watchers whose company he found congenial. To be tapped for this fraternity was a high honor, and ever since, for the Dawn Birds, the sun has come up in an aura of poetry and glowing memories. The star-shaped symbol scratched above the door of the parsonage and on a cement block in the interior of Parker Memorial is the emblem of the Dawn Birds. Still another signature disappeared in the great storm of 1978, which ripped the concrete capping from the large area of the pier. So I didn't originally understand from that description the amount of commitment that was required to participate. From his son, Ed Rutledge, at his memorial service on Star, I learned that they gathered on the east end of the porch around midnight, walked out to East Rock by flashlight, turned out their lights, and waited in silence for 4 or 5 hours in anticipation of the sunrise and the new day. It was greatly symbolic and spiritual ritual that was very close to their hearts. There are many places where the symbol can be found. Like Fred says, it's above the door of the parsonage, as well as in Parker with initials and a date. It can be found in at least 2 of Lyman's published books here in Earth Music. as well as In Pursuit of Reality, Star Island Reveries. There's even a booklet of the Secret Society and some of its members that I digitized when I was the Vaughn curator. One of my favorite figures of Star Island's more contemporary history is Bobby Warham. Bobby worked on the Isles of Shoals from 1946 to 1962 for 17 years. He worked as the chief engineer and also as the winter keeper, alone on the island all winter. He won the Caldecott Medal of Honor for saving someone from drowning off East Rock. During his tenure, a fire began in a wooden gutter off Gosport Heights, a part of the fourth floor of the current Oceanic Hotel that they couldn't reach with any of their ladders. So Bobby Warham was hung out a window by his ankles, holding nothing but an axe to reach through the flames, and he chopped that wooden gutter off the building and it fell to the ground where it could be extinguished. Lyman Rutledge saved a charred piece of the gutter to show at orientations of new guests in hopes that they would take fire safety seriously, as this fire was started by a cigarette and could have been avoided. Bobby Warham has other wild stories attributed to him, one of wrestling an 8-foot blue shark in the harbor, which I'm less likely to believe. Once he stopped working at the Shoals, he worked in the Seacoast Machinist Shop and drove to Rye on his commute every morning, out of his way, just to look out to sea at the islands in the distance. I imagine that the islands haunted Bobby after he left, which I think is true for many. It reminds me of the repetitive last line of the chant they shout at the end of the pier on Star Island, to departing staff and guests alike, part hopeful, part threat, part assurance. You will come back, you will come back, you will come back. I hope you enjoyed my talk. Does anyone have any questions?
Is there any truth to the rumor that Duck Island was used for bombing practice during World War II?
Absolutely. Yeah, I almost put it in there. It went in and then it came out again because there's a lot of things that had to come out, actually.
Yeah.
Yes, they did use it, and it is currently off limits for anyone to land on because they are afraid that there could be unexploded ordnance still out there. And or, I guess there's a lot of chemicals in those bombs, which makes sense. So there could also be some crazy chemicals around that you don't want to get into. So they're fairly certain, I think, that it's not. There probably isn't like live bombs going off, but or ready to go off, but just to keep it safe, they do have some sort of a cleanup operation that I think is slated to happen at some point, but I think it's kind of low on the list.
When you approach by kayak, there's a lot of like really turbulent water, and
yeah.
I was wondering if that was because of the craters from the.
I don't know. I don't know how much they bombed out there. I mean. It doesn't look too crazy on the island. It looks like the rest of the islands.
Yeah.
But it is ill-advised to go out there. Yes. Yeah?
Yeah, 74, 75, live bombing was it?
Oh, really? I don't
yeah,
know.
Two rocket divers.
Wow.
5-pound bomb. They thought it was inert because we were all told when I drove up there.
Yeah.
The bombs were filled with sand.
Oh, okay. Right.
You put it in the back of a pickup truck. Drove through Portsmouth and went down Atlantic Aquasport and Rye.
Yeah.
And he had it as an ornamentation out in front of his dive shop. In fact, 2 days before it was determined that it was a live bomb, I helped Don Stevens move the bomb from one side to the other. Two fellows from Fort Devens came up to get their tanks filled and deemed it was a live bomb.
Yeah.
And they took it over to the old High Fuller pit and detonated it.
That's terrible.
Is there any hard evidence that there was treasure found that helped fund some of the building on Star?
No, there was no proof of that. Are you talking about the silver bars that Sam Haley
they said silver
may have
gold
found?
Coins were found.
What I have heard is that Sam Haley or Sam Haley Sr. may have found some bars of silver on Smutty Nose. but that was never confirmed to my knowledge. Do you know, Joe?
Yeah, in the 60s, when I was out there, between Smutty Nose and the other little island, there was a breakwater. And it was kind of something like I would build, not very good. And then the other end of it was very good. Well, he was picking up stone, and he picked up a bar of silver. So he no longer was in the breakwater business. He had it high. He built a little flat. He thought it was just another rock. And when he put it in, he scraped some of the stuff off and saw the silver. So it was like one of the megaliths. But as far as I know, that was the only thing there. The silver, it's very good history of stuff being buried there, but back in the 1600s, what are shoals now, were islands then. You know, you take a lot of those out towards Duck and so forth, at low tide, they're almost above water, so, you know, 400 years ago, it looked a lot different than now.
Yeah, that's the only other thing I had heard, was I had heard that there was some sort of underground imaging where they had found some sort of metal on Lunging Island deep down, and that there could have been some sort of an entryway to a cove that used to, you know, be lower on the water level or something. But that also has like no real truth to it. It's just something I randomly heard at some point. In the back?
Did you come across anything about Pirate Philip Babb and Oceanborn Mary?
I have definitely heard about Philip Babb. I don't think I've heard about Mary. There was a female, trying to remember her name, Rachel Wall. I have heard of Rachel Wall was out there for sure, and she would put up the distress signal and sort of like prey on the pity of other sailors, and I think she had a boyfriend or a husband who would help attack people, but I haven't heard of a Mary, I don't.
The legend that I'm referring to involves the pirate named Philip Babb or Don Pedro. Sometimes they're confused. And he was on a raiding party.
Uh-huh.
And he boarded the ship to steal from it or hijack it or whatever. And he heard the cry of a newborn baby.
Mm.
He went down below to see it. And he was so enchanted that he asked the mother to name the baby Mary after his mother, which she supposedly did. And years later, he brought her some green brocade fabric for a wedding gown. And as I understand it, there's a piece of that in the Henniger Library in New Hampshire.
Okay, cool.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, I hadn't heard that. Yeah, Philip Babb was a butcher on Appledore Island, and some people said that he was friendly with pirates and that could have been a pirate. And there's ghost stories on Appledore about Philip Babb with his butchers, bloody butchers chasing people. But I'd definitely not heard that before. It's very interesting. Yeah.
There's a whole book about Oceanborn Mary by Lois Lenski.
Great.
Telling all of the stuff about growing up in Portsmouth and visiting somebody on the island. Perhaps people would enjoy reading that.
Sure. Can you say that title once again so I can repeat it? Oceanborn Mary is a book.
By Lois Lenski.
N-S-K-I.
And I think it was written in 39.
Written in 39. Okay, great. Yeah. Yep.
Do you have any thoughts on how the Appledore House burned down?
I would have to look back at notes about that. I do believe there was speculation that it could have been a little bit too convenient, because I do believe it was shortly after they closed for the season, and you know, they were trying to sell the islands and the hotel, and potentially something could have been amiss there. Oscar was on, I think he was on Star Island at the time, and then he rode over, but like, I don't know, it's hard to think about. He also lost so much of his family's things there. And maybe that was unforeseen if he had any hand in that, but I don't know. I have no idea.
That's
okay. Yeah.
Any shipwrecks you can talk about?
There are more shipwrecks, but none that I'm super versed in that I can think of. Yeah. Anything else? Thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming out.